have on my recording, so I'm just recording it now. So I'll just back up 10 seconds and say that what I want to address is you know, why we've been doing this analysis, especially when it's difficult. It's hard to find the juice in it. It's hard to have a feeling that we're really addressing our own experience. Why we've been doing it, what's involved in it, and how we're going to be taking a different approach now. So the first thing, and this is something that people will often say about time, space, and knowledge in general, and I just don't think it holds, but in these chapters you might say that it does, is that it's a very conceptual analysis. You know, Rinpoche has been going through the logic of our understanding. First of all, our understanding of time in terms of polar knowledge and descriptive knowledge, and second, the logic of how we make sense out of our experience and how what we think of as being real in the end refers back to models and interpretations and really nothing else. And that's a conceptual analysis, you know, it's the kind of thing you would get in a philosophy course in college. And some people may be very interested in it, but some people may say, well, I didn't take philosophy in college, I don't see why I should have to take it now, or something to that effect. The other danger, one danger is to say, well, it's too conceptual, I don't see how this really relates to my own experience. The other danger for people who have explored these kinds of questions in the past is to say, well, I know this. And Rinpoche actually speaks to that on page 139 of the reading. He says, well, philosophers and students of knowledge, that's the term he uses, philosophers and students of knowledge have been aware of these kinds of difficulties. It's hard to make sense out of experience. So there is a danger on that other side of saying, well, okay, sure, I understand, it's all interpretations. But in both cases, you're left with the same kind of reaction, which is basically a so what reaction. You know, so, okay, conceptually I understand this is problematic, but that doesn't really seem to have an impact on me and the way I live my life, and it doesn't tell me what kind of changes I should make. You know, suppose that I started to see the world differently, and I said, oh, yes, interpretations, everything is all interpretations. Would that change my life? Well, in fact, it would. But as long as we're thinking of it as a conceptual kind of analysis, we don't really see why. So in part, that's what we're doing now. We want to be able to move from that conceptual level of insight to a more lived experiential sense of insight. And my sense is that a good way to think about that, a good way to approach it, is to go back to the last program we did in the fall. Not all of you were taking part in that program. Many of you were. But in that program at the very beginning, we were talking about what Rinpoche calls technological knowledge. And his definition of technological knowledge is that it's knowledge about how to get what the self wants. It's knowledge that involves techniques or technologies for satisfying the desires of the self. And even the kind of theoretical knowledge that we have is, the kind of conceptual analysis we've been doing is still a kind of technological knowledge, even though we don't normally think of it as having practical consequences, which is part of the problem. It's still a kind of technological knowledge because it's the self doing this analysis for whatever reason, you know, to try to straighten out its own thinking, to try to arrive at some better approach to getting what it wants. It's still all in the realm of technological knowledge. And the underlying analysis that Rinpoche does that we looked at last quarter is about how it is that the self comes to be the one that's, you know, how it stands in that relationship to knowledge. That knowledge is about getting what the self wants. Because that's not the only kind of knowledge we could imagine. It's easy enough to think of other kinds of knowledge. There could be a kind of pervasive knowledge in the universe, for instance, that doesn't have anything to do with the self. But that's not technological knowledge. So the question is, why is technological knowledge so central in Rinpoche's analysis and in the way he presents things? And he answers that question, or at least, you know, presents the foundation for analysis, for an answer, in Chapter 5 of Love of Knowledge, which, when we worked with it last quarter, I'm sure I said, you know, that's one of my favorite chapters, and I'm actually going to recommend, I'm going to put this in the orientation for next week, that you go back and look at Chapter 5. If you haven't read it before, probably most of you have, but if you haven't read it before, read it now. If you have read it before, go ahead and take a look at it again, because I think it helps explain a lot of what we've been doing. What Rinpoche says, I'm going to summarize it now, but actually I'm going to read a little bit of it in a couple of minutes. But what Rinpoche says in Chapter 5 is that we have an understanding of the relationship between the self and its world, which actually is really dualistic. All cultures have a kind of a dualistic understanding, or all cultures have a commitment to the idea of the self. Our culture, Western culture, modern culture, is not unique in that. But there is something unique about the Western way of understanding the relationship between the self and the world. And it has to do, and this is not exactly something that Rinpoche spells out, although I think he really gets to the heart of it in a really, you know, a remarkable way. I mean, just a few pages, he lays out some really fundamentally important ideas. But other people have written about these kinds of things. And one of the points that often gets made is that the modern world has a different understanding of the self. And that understanding, fundamentally, is that the self is the one that gives meaning to the world. And it's a good idea, I think, helpful to contrast that to a more traditional understanding, and in fact an understanding that we still find in our culture if you look at people who follow a traditional Western religion. The traditional understanding is that the world itself is meaningful. So one way to think about that, or one way to experience that, is that God has created the world, and that events in the world serve God's purposes and unfold according to God's plan. Now, that's only one isolated way, or one particular example of how you could say the world was meaningful, but it's one that we all know something about from our own culture. So in a traditional view, you say the world itself is meaningful, and then the self has to find its place within that meaningful world. But in our culture, we basically say the world is meaningless. There's a quote that I'm fond of. I don't think we used it in this class. From the beginning of the modern age, the French philosopher Pascal is writing about space, and he says, "The vast silence of infinite space terrifies me." And I like that sentence because it highlights the shift, you can say, well, that moment when Pascal says that crystallizes the shift that is taking place in modern culture. The world becomes a meaningless place, and you can talk about Copernicus and the fact that the Earth no longer is the center of the universe, and you can talk about Descartes' analysis, which really I think is kind of comes after the fact. By the time of Descartes, there's already this suspicion, this fear that the world is meaningless and that the only thing that gives meaning to the world is the self. Even though Descartes tries to tie it back into God in a way that's not so successful, according to most people. So we live in a world in which all meaning comes from the self, but the reality of the world is outside the self. The reality of the world is this objective reality that science then takes on as its domain of inquiry. You know, science is what's going to find out about the objective world, including the self insofar as it's part of the objective world. But the self, the one that gives meaning, withdraws. And that's what chapter 5 is about, that split, that the self finds itself in a world where it is the one that imposes meaning. And that's actually where we're going to start in the reading for next week, that meaning comes from the self. And it's because of that, it's because the world that the self inhabits is in itself meaningless, and the self is the one that gives meaning, that split. That has a lot to do with why it's been difficult to, I think, to connect to the kind of analysis, or why it is can be difficult, let's say, to connect to the kind of analysis that we've been exploring in the last few weeks. You can analyze the workings of time, you can analyze our knowledge of the world and say, you know, it's all models, it's all constructs, it's all interpretations. And all you're doing is confirming this basic model of the self as being trapped in its own realm. And that's a very profound kind of commitment that we make to understanding the role of meaning in the world. And the result of it is really that any kind of analysis is not going to affect us. You know, the analysis, there's an interesting kind of conspiracy, or maybe you should say partnership is a more neutral word. There's an interesting partnership between abstract reasoning and objective reality. Abstract reasoning is based on there being some reality that you can reason about, and it's much more complicated than that, but for our purpose I think we can say that much. And so you do all this analysis and first of all you say, you know, the world is only interpretations and constructs and models, and we already kind of know that, because that's fundamental to the nature of the self. We may not have thought about it that way, but, and in fact, most people don't think about it that way. Most people just assume that what's real is real. You know, there's a famous story about Samuel Johnson, who lived in England in, I think, the 17th century. You know, I guess it was more the 18th century. 18th century, and he heard about this theory that the world is really a construct of the mind. This was Bishop Berkeley's theory, for whom Berkeley is named, for those of you who are local. But Berkeley said that it wasn't our minds, our individual minds, it was God's mind. So that you know, this is not a course on philosophy, but you can say that that's an interesting attempt by Berkeley to kind of save the reality of the world in the face of this realization that everything is just a construct. You know? He says, yeah, it's a construct, but it's God's construct. It's not our construct. Anyway, he says that, and Samuel Johnson heard about this theory while somebody was talking to him as they walked down the street telling him about this. And Johnson kicked a rock that was lying in the street, and he said, I refute him thus. You know, it's the reality of the world in the common sense view is just self-evident. And actually, Rinpoche goes into that I think at the end of the last chapter, and he says, "Well, of course it's true. No, don't bother me with your theories." So there is that tendency. But even though we accept, in the common sense view, we accept the reality of the world in that way, if you push it, it's not very hard for people to understand, because it is ultimately our view that that the world is a construct. I see a technical question from Tina. I'm going to make my telephone speakers a little louder. I hope that helps. And then I see a question from Lois about the relationship between science and self versus world before Descartes. I'm not quite sure what... that's not exactly how I was trying to phrase it, but the basic idea is that we have a subjective world. That's the world Descartes lives in, and he is trying to reestablish that world, and that is exactly also what science does, without getting philosophical about it. It says, well, we have to know this objective reality, which in fact is meaningless, which in fact is not our subjective world. I'm going to leave it at that, and Lois, maybe you and I can exchange an email about that if you'd like to hear a little more. So I was starting to say that even though in a common sense way we accept the reality of the world, there is another part of our common sense understanding which is remarkably open to the idea that everything is a construct. And I was actually struck in reading this chapter, and thinking of the word, thinking of the movie, The Matrix, which I'm assuming most of you have seen. If you look at page 141 in the reading, Rinpoche actually uses the word matrix. It's in the first full paragraph. He says, "Suppose that what we understood to be fundamental elements of experience, in other words, our ordinary reality, were simply interpreted projections onto a random matrix with meanings, actions, and results, all expressions of the original act of projection." Well, in a certain sense, that's the, not exactly the plot summary, but the underlying assumption of the movie The Matrix. Now, this book was written, 10, 15 years before that movie. But what's remarkable, what's interesting to me about that, is that the, that people, without having studied philosophy particularly, are really just completely open to that idea. They can easily understand the concept of the movie, The Matrix, and that concept is that the world is nothing but a projection. And if you could feed the mind different kinds of data, which is what goes on in that movie, you could make it believe that it was experiencing a certain reality. And in fact, a lot of philosophy courses nowadays will have their students view The Matrix and try to use that. And there are books written about the philosophical implications and so on. Well, maybe they got it all from this paragraph of Love of Knowledge, but I don't know. The difficulty then is that we find ourselves in this world, we say, yeah, it's all projections, and it's not me, right? I'm in this other realm, this subjective realm, right? And the problem, the difficulty then, is that you can't really affect the self. And the kind of analysis that we've been doing doesn't really affect the self. And in Chapter 5, Rinpoche really addresses that in a very clear way. I'm going to read it to you a little bit with some comments, I guess. It's on page 37, starting with the first full paragraph. And he's talking about how, about knowledge that's based on thinking and models, as being a kind of a second-class citizen. That's the term that he uses. Because in the subjective realm, what really matters more is our desires. and our emotions. And we're going to talk about that in a moment, because that has a lot to do with the shift that we're going to make. But in the subjective, okay, so thinking and models do have some power. But then he says, and this is where I want to read, he says, when new knowledge does arise, it is understood as being bound to the objective realm, which is not the realm of the self. Thus, such knowledge does not directly affect the self in its being. Though conceptual models, new scientific theories, or new ideologies may seem inspiring, the response they evoke fails to bridge the gap between the being of the self and the being of the world that the self somehow inhabits. The direct consequence of this pattern is that the impact of even the most powerful insights quickly fades. As we discover that the knowledge we attain seems incapable of transforming our being, we may lose confidence in the value of knowledge to affect our lives. And I'll stop there. That's the dilemma, and it applies completely to the reading we've been doing. You know, you say, well, we've been doing an analysis that helps us to understand that the world that we accept as real is not real in the sense that we think, and we have talked a little bit about the potential for that being an inspiring view. We've tended to focus more on the fact that we're just thoroughly mistaken. But it's also a potentially inspiring view. As we've been saying in the last few weeks, the question that we're asking when we look into the nature of reality is the question whether we are free, whether we have the potential to be differently. I did a workshop yesterday on creativity from a TSK perspective, and that really is the same issue. Where does the potential for bringing something new into the world, for creating something new, where can it possibly come from if the world unfolds in this objective way? So that's the question we're asking, and we can say, okay, when we do the analysis and we see that really what we accept as real is a construct, is an interpretation, we are allowing for the possibility that it could all be different and that we really could transform our being or engage in truly creative action. That's the inspiring dimension of that analysis. But as Rinpoche writes in the section I was just reading from, it doesn't affect us. It doesn't affect us because the self is not part of that world. The self is not, you can't touch the self through reasoning. You can't touch the self through a conceptual analysis. You do all of that, and it's kind of like Samuel Johnson kicking the stone. The self says, but here I am. You know? And I know what I know. I want what I want. I'm not really very interested in what you have to tell me. I mean, it may be fine for a philosophy course, you know. It may be fine for late night discussions when you're in college, which seem to be in the time when that kind of conceptual analysis, the time in our lives when that conceptual analysis somehow speaks to us very strongly. That may all be great, and we may even wander around for a while, amazed by the possibility that everything could be different. But then it fades. And then we go back to being the self that we always are. So, the point then becomes to look at that self that we always are. And there's a kind of a two-step analysis that Rinpoche begins to do at the very end of this chapter that I want to point us towards. The first point that he makes is that from the perspective of the self, but the word perspective is actually a little bit wrong. Because perspective sounds like taking a distance. We look at something from a distance. It's much more a question from the experience of the self. You know, in the way that the self experiences the world, the proof, the test for reality has nothing to do with any kind of argument. It's the equivalent of kicking the stone. The proof or the test for reality is the feeling that something is real. And that feeling can show up in all sorts of different ways. It can be sensory experience, you know. If I pinch myself, there's a certain feeling that goes with that, and we associate that with reality. But it also just has to do with what it's like when we wake up in the morning and become aware of being in bed, become aware of the room around us. There's a feel to that. And that's exactly what Rinpoche describes. He uses this example of a cup on the table in front of you. And he says, if you close your eyes and imagine the cup, that's one kind of experience. If you open your eyes and look at the cup, that's a different kind of experience. The difference between those two, that's the feeling of reality. And reality is based on a feeling. And that's actually a pretty surprising notion. You could say it's a kind of idealism, that it's saying the objective world is not objectively real. It's only our feeling that it's real that matters. That sort of sounds like saying, oh, it's just, you know, we create the world. But it isn't like that. And there's some truth to that, but it isn't like that because part of the characteristic of the world that we feel is that it has objective reality. You know, one of the ways we know we're talking about an objective world is that it operates according to laws of cause and effect. That's only one limited area, but that's a perfectly good place to look. But it's not as though the laws of cause and effect prove that the world is real. It's rather that our knowing that the laws of cause and effect operate are the indicator, are part of the feeling of the reality of what we encounter. So, you know, if I look at something in front of me, if I look at the computer here, there is the feel of that computer and in fact the table and the room and the building and the city and the whole thing. There's that feeling that the whole thing is real. Part of that feeling is also a knowing, and the knowing is that if the computer were to fall off the table and hit me, it would hurt, you know, it would have an impact on my body. So we know that, but we don't know it abstractly. We know it in a kind of a feelingful way. You know, the knowledge is really subordinated to the feeling and helps establish the feeling. So that may start to sound a little conceptual again, but really where it's going is that what we need to do if we want to analyze, or no, not the right word, what we need to do if we want to understand our situation as selves in a world, and that is really our theme here, and in some ways it's the central theme of time, space, and knowledge, what we need to do if we want to analyze our understanding of the self in the world, if we want to explore it, we need a neutral word.
Apprehend.
Apprehend is, well, yeah, although if you look literally at the meaning of apprehend, that's a little problematic because it means grasp it, you know. But yeah, anyway, not analyze. Analyze is a bad word. So explore is a nice neutral word, I think. If we want to explore it, understand it more deeply, that's actually pretty good because we're interested in changing our relationship to the possibilities that we have. So what we need to do is go into that realm of feeling, which establishes everything. And that means going into the sense of the witness. Right? Now, Rinpoche introduces the concept of the witness at the end of this chapter, and then he's going to set it aside a little bit for a little while, and we'll come back to it. Because, and the reason he can do that is because he says, look, when we're talking about the witness, we're talking about the self. The self is the one who lays ownership, who claims ownership of that feeling. I want to address a question that Arthur puts here. He says, when we speak of the feeling of reality, are we close to the patterns of intentionality that were discussed in the last chapter? I'm not sure. I'd have to look back at how that term, patterns of intentionality, is used in the last chapter. But probably the answer is yes, because in fact it turns out that intentionality is really central to the self as witness, you know, to the self as the one that feels its way into a reality. So we're looking at something, let me say a little more about that. Usually when we talk about trying to establish something conceptually, it's through thinking, right? When we talk about the self in its world and the reality, what counts as reality for the world? It's not thinking, it's intentionality. And intentionality in the sense, for now we can certainly say, in the sense of what the self wants, what the self desires, what the self needs. It turns out that that's really way more central to the self in operation than any kind of thinking, any kind of model, any kind of interpretation. And that's another reason why it's not so helpful experientially to look at those levels. So you may well ask, so why did we spend, several chapters looking at that conceptually? And the answer really is that we had to clear away the underbrush, as we say sometimes in English, We had to, in order to be able to make our way into this new realm where we're going to be investigating the self and the world in terms of the self's understanding, which is so different, we had to get rid of some of our ordinary assumptions. And that's really what we've been doing. So I think this bears more investigation, and we won't do it. And sometime, perhaps, somebody can do it. But, exactly how those parts fit together, the conceptual analysis we've been doing and where we're headed now, I think that needs to be analyzed more. But the basic idea here is that we're about to make this fundamental shift. We're about to look at the self in operation in terms of its concerns, its intentionality. So I'm not sure, Tina, whether your laugh, your ha-ha, takes back what you just said about not spending enough time on models. Does that make it all a joke? Maybe. Anyway, if we need to talk more about models, let's do it online. I want to make one more point in terms of kind of connecting this up to some current ideas in the field of cognitive science, let's say. There was a pretty influential book written about 10, 12 years ago by a cognitive scientist, I think he is, named Antonio Damasio. He wrote a book called Descartes' Error, Descartes' Mistake. And basically, what he calls Descartes' Mistake was exactly leaving out the emotional dimension. And I think his analysis in the end is not all that helpful, but that basic point is very similar, you could say, to the point that we're making here. Being a self is not about the kind of cause and effect mode of thinking that applies in the objective world. Being a self is about wanting and desiring and needing and willing. And that whole dimension is, that's what Damasio says, that's what Descartes left out, and I think that's right. And you could say that's why it's very difficult to use the thinking mind to go anywhere that is fruitful for questioning the self or transforming our way of being. And we've kind of been struggling with that difficulty. So now we can move on to, I think, what will probably be a more easily approachable way of looking at the self. I'm going to post some things in the orientation. I'm going to suggest some practices. You know, we've been trying to look at the self in operation. The practices we'll look at now are a little different from that. But I'll post those. We're done for today. So I knew that this was going to be a lot of talking today, that it was going to mostly be jack, jack, jack. But I did think it was important to put this in a perspective so that we can now move forward from there. And hopefully next week we'll have more discussion, and online also. I'm sure there are a lot of issues here. So as you go ahead with the reading for next week, and please, if you can, do look back at Chapter 5 also. As questions come up, be sure to go online, and I'll be looking online to help continue the discussion. Okay, thank you.